They started as performers. When Eddie, the older brother, was 8 years old, and his little sister, they had seen a circus and set up some crude rigging in their backyard. And then in, I think it was 1903, went to the Atlanta State Fair and did kind of an act on their own. They passed the hat, and the story goes they collected $400, which they presented to their mother. And their mother said, "You're not going back to school. You're making the family a living." Because imagine, do the inflation calculator in your head, right? That's a big, big sum for children to make.
A common, often tongue-in-cheek suggestion for a career path, or a break from one, would be running off to join the circus. At one point, in the modest-sized town of Bloomington, Illinois, that option was a viable one, and those that did started a trend that entwined Bloomington with the history of the Big Top. This is Random Acts of Knowledge, presented by Heartland Community College. I'm your host, Steve Fast. Today's guest manages a huge collection of circus artifacts and memorabilia at Illinois State University. She explains why ISU is the home of such a large collection of circus ephemera and why the circus is tied to Central Illinois history.
I'm Maureen Brunstad. I'm the Special Collections Librarian at Illinois State University, and I'm coming to Heartland later in October to do a session on circus history of this community.
I think a lot of people that come to this community, or maybe even grow up in this community, don't realize that there is such a connection to circus history. So how did it all start with Bloomington Normal and the circus?
You know, it all goes back to a person I consider the most overlooked man in American history, and that's Jesse Fell. Who's Jesse Fell? Do you know?
I do know who Jesse Fell is.
He
is connected with Abraham Lincoln.
Exactly.
He has a couple of very prominent streets named after him here in Bloomington Normal.
He founded the university, Illinois State University.
And he was a mover and shaker in Illinois politics.
Where would we be without Jesse Fell? You know, he's the guy who convinced Lincoln to run for president.
Right.
Maybe not in these United States, but he had a nephew. And that nephew opened the first gymnasium in Bloomington. I can't make this up. The nephew's name was I. Fell. He went by his first initial. And in that first gymnasium in the mid-1870s, downtown Bloomington, he installed this relatively newfangled apparatus for exhibition. It had been used as an exercise apparatus before, but had never been used as something that could entertain people, and that was the trapeze. Invented by a guy you also know, whether or not you realize it, but his name was Jules Liotard, right? Liotard.
Right, so they named that after him.
Right, exactly. The Liotard is named after him, but he invented trapeze in Paris, France, in the 1850s. And so it was really incredible, nearly 25 years later, that that apparatus was installed in this new gym downtown Bloomington at the corner of East and Washington Streets. And that first gymnasium was open to all the men in the community. There was a subscription you had to pay to belong, which made sense. And then every spring they had an exhibition of talent. Well, a couple of young men, young boys, really teenagers, had belonged to that gym and did a routine on the trapeze that the local newspaper said were every bit as good as professional troopers. Well, that's all those boys needed to hear, right? Going back to school or trooping as a circus performer, which would you choose? They chose being circus performers. So they went out, and we have not found any evidence of how they did that first season, but you wouldn't expect it. But they came back to this community in the wintertime to practice their craft and then went out again successive seasons and started growing their fame.
Before this, the traveling circuses or carnivals or whatever had no trapeze act at all?
Correct. Well, no, they'd had a trapeze act in the circuses. The way we think of trapeze with a flyer and a catcher and doing tricks between the two bars, if you will, was not really in evidence at that time. There were single trapeze performers, but even it was in its infancy at that time.
How common was it to see any trapeze at all in gymnasium setting or anywhere else before this?
I don't know. I've never done the research on that to see how prevalent trapezes were. But I can tell you that from Jules Liotard, quote unquote, inventing the trapeze to it becoming a finishing act for circuses, it didn't take very long for that to happen. And I think perhaps that's because of the danger involved. Audiences kind of thrill to see a dangerous act, and what could be more dangerous than watching people over your head do incredible stunts, even with a net below, when the net can kill you if you land wrong in it. That's a big deal.
Did word get out about this particular act and then it became more popular? Did that somehow draw more people to Bloomington Normal? How did it continue?
Yeah, great question. So their act, like I said, we don't know how they first few seasons of their act went. But over successive seasons, they kept saying to people, you know, come back to Bloomington practice in our community because we have the space for it. We're not as expensive as Chicago or St. Louis. There's good rail service between those two towns. Come and practice like they did in the gymnasium that was in town, and then later the YMCA that was built that had rigging permanently installed to support the flying trapeze, and then the barn that was on East Emerson Street that was also built for the specific purpose of training trapeze flyers. So we had this wonderful training ground, and I would say, because I'm a farm kid, beautifully strong farm kids to actually take up the art of flying and being fearless while doing it.
So was this something that was seasonal? Was this something that, this is the time when people come here to train on the trapeze and the rest of the time they're back wherever else? Was that how it worked?
Well, generally how it worked was circuses back in the day, and I'm talking the late 1800s through the 1950s, really before circuses got into buildings, they would perform under canvas in the tent, right? And that tented season would start generally in April and end in October. So what would happen is the performers would go out and perform for those weeks, and then they'd come back to Bloomington, or they'd go back for home, wherever home was, for a couple weeks, and then come to Bloomington and then practice their craft and then go out again.
So yeah, since the barn was inside and heated and all that, they didn't need to worry about any of that.
Exactly.
Okay, so how did this develop after that? Were there other iterations of circus performing that then followed this along?
Yeah, so the Levans were the first, the Green Brothers. They performed professionally as the Levans, and they did so for about 50 years, which is unheard of. It's like Tom Cruise, right? Having a 50-year stay in the market of entertainment is phenomenal, but that was the Levans. And word just kept spreading that we had these facilities and we were willing to train people. And then if you wanted to get finished as an artist, you knew to come to Bloomington. And it just kept snowballing, if you will, over the course of decades.
Now, did we have trapeze coaches that lived here that made their home in this area? You think of other, I guess, sports camps, right? You have somebody that has a job, and then they take the summer, in the case, not here, because that's the circus season, but, you know, they'll train people to come to baseball camp or gymnastics camp or something. Was it similar in how these performers were trained?
Yeah, you know, there was act captains. You can think of them as that, or act managers that were also in the act. One of the first is also one of the most well-known, and that was Eddie Ward. Eddie and his sister Jenny were the ones responsible for building that barn on Emerson Street that became this training ground for so many. Eddie Ward would contract all of his acts with the American Circus Corporation. So, for example, Mickey King was an orphaned girl who grew up in Vermont and the area, Canada and the U.S. in that upper northeast area of the country, and she went to see a circus and fell in love and thought that's a better job than working as a 16-year-old in the woolen mills. And so she was hired on and ended the season back here in Bloomington, and then eventually, under Eddie Ward's tutelage and her own grit and determination, becomes Billboard's Female Performer of the Year, 1936. That's a pretty big deal, right? What did she claim as hometown? Was it in Vermont or was it Bloomington? It was Bloomington. That's just one example.
So how prevalent were circuses back then? Were there a bunch of little circuses, a couple of big circuses? What was the structure of this style of entertainment back then?
Yeah, this entertainment was the number one form of entertainment. From, I'm going to say, golly, the first circus in America was 1793. You can't say it was started then. The circus started then for sure, but was that the number one entertainment form? No. But certainly by the mid-1800s up through 1950, circus was the number one form of entertainment in this country. You didn't have to go far to see it. It came to you. And there were all sorts of sizes of circuses. There were the big shows, the Ringling Brothers, the Barnum and Bailey, and then when they joined in 1919, Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey. There were the smaller shows, and the main competition to Ringling was the American Circus Corporation in Peru, Indiana. And those were the John Robinson, Sells Floto, Hagenbeck Wallace. There were five of them all told. But then there were other family circuses that would troop as well. So wonderfully rich and varied form of entertainment for your various sizes of circuses.
Not kind of like unlike some theater today.
Yeah,
you can see a local production of something. You can see a touring production of something. Or they have touring productions in big cities that do runs. And then they have two or three places where, like Broadway or something.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
What would a regular circus have been like around the time that this was at the heyday of Bloomington's involvement in the circus? Like if you were to go see one of the bigger circuses, what would you see in terms of the variety of the trapeze acts, but what else?
Oh, golly. Well, it would start with the circus coming into town on a train, right? And children of all ages would go down to watch the unloading of the equipment and then the setting up on the lot to see how man and beast work together to get that done. And then in the up and through, I'm going to say the 1920s, when automobiles were really coming to the fore is when this kind of ended, there would be a parade through town, and it would end with the calliope, the cacophonous calliope sound. It's a calliope, but circus people call it calliope, and I've been trained to say it right from their perspective. But it would have a spectacle. Every theme had a spectacle, which was a quasi-entertaining, quasi-educational theme. So it could be something like Joan of Arc, or it could be something like Columbus discovering America for Barnum and Bailey in 1892, the anniversary of that happening, so that schools, teachers could take their children to the circus, and then they could see the show and hear the music and see wonderful things they'd never seen before, or maybe only heard of, perhaps in church. People from foreign lands, animals from foreign lands. The first zoos in the country were actually part of the circus, menageries. It was just a wildly disparate, they often likened it to a dream, setting up in a lot. And then you're there all day watching the whole process, watching the show. And then by the time you fall asleep, you wake up the next day and there's nothing there. Was it a dream? You know, that's kind of the romanticized version of the circus back then.
We see this connection with the trapeze and circus in Bloomington. Were there other traditions or other elements of how the circus evolved that were tied to Bloomington Normal?
Well, you know, Bloomington Normal also had, we had wire walkers that lived in town, and we had other managers that lived in town, advance agents, that kind of thing. But really, the number, the quantity of trapeze performers we had outweigh the others that we had in town related to the circus.
Well, you mentioned the one performer who came from Vermont and joined
Mickey
the circus.
King.
Mickey King. What other famous performers came through? Tell us some of these stories of these people.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I told you about Eddie and Jenny Ward. They started as performers. When Eddie, the older brother, was 8 years old, and his little sister, they had seen a circus and set up some crude rigging in their backyard. And then in, I think it was 1903, went to the Atlanta State Fair and did kind of an act on their own. They passed the hat, and the story goes they collected $400, which they presented to their mother. And their mother said, "You're not going back to school. You're making the family a living." Because imagine, do the inflation calculator in your head, right? That's a big, big sum for children to make. But they did. They continued their career and were very, very famous first as double trapeze performers. So one trapeze bar over the other, same set of ropes on either side, no net below. And Jenny attained such a following, if you will, an international following, that there was a young British interviewer looking for a magazine that was hounding her for an interview. She finally said, "Yes, I'll do this interview with you," and sat for the interview, and he asked some wonderful questions about her upbringing, and then he said, "Are you not scared of anything? I watch you do flips from the top bar to the bottom bar where you're caught by your ankles with your brother. Are you never scared?" And she said, "Well, no. He's my brother. Of course he's going to catch me." And so the journalist thought about that for a while, and he said, "Well, are you scared of anything?" And she said, "Oh, yes. I'm scared of two things. I'm scared of fire, and I'm scared of trains." And he could understand fire, of course. "But why trains?" And she said, "Well, if I'm crossing the street and a heel should get stuck in a rail and a train is coming, what's going to happen?" Well, how did she die, Steve? In a railroad accident, in flames.
Crazy. Hopefully,
1918.
She should have worn flats.
Well, she wasn't run over.
Oh, okay.
It was a railroad accident, the Hagenbeck-Wallace railroad accident of 1918, but tragic.
Crazy story.
It is a crazy story, but that's just two. And his most famous pupil was Art Cancello, a guy I just wrote a book about, who was a truant, who was pulled off the street by his ear by the YMCA physical director and said, "Kid, you need to learn something. You're not doing anything with your life. You're skipping school. Your life's going to go down the drain. What are you going to do?" And supposedly Art looked up at the rigging that was permanently installed in the Y and said, any money in that? And the physical director's response was, yeah, but you got to be good at it. And who knew that that guy, Art Cancello, was a natural? And then he becomes a flyer first for Eddie Ward. And after Eddie Ward passes away, he takes that model and tweaks it, refines it, has, I think at one point, 8 different acts reporting to him from Russia to England and, of course, several in America, Australia as well. And then works his way up through management, ending his career as executive vice president for Ringling Brothers Barnum Bailey.
Wow.
Yeah.
You mentioned the span of when this hit its popularity, and you say that, was it after World War II that it kind of peaked? And
yep.
So mm-hmm. At what point did Bloomington become less of a circus town? Was it a gradual decline, or was it something that just as circuses had a lot more competition with TV and...
I think circuses started to decline when those competitors really started ramping up their advertising, mm-hmm. right? But I think what really changed for Bloomington was the centralization of all artists in places like Sarasota. But here's the thing about Sarasota. When I first went to Sarasota and I met with retired circus performers there, they treated me like a rock star. I'm not a rock star. But they were like, God, you're from Bloomington? Bloomington, Illinois? Is the barn still there? Is the Y still there? Tell me the rigging's still there. And of course it isn't, but it's still in the minds of so many, in Sarasota at least, it's still a fond place. It's not where their art, and that's how they refer to it, it's their art. It's not where their art was created, but it's where it was refined. And it's a special place for so many for that reason.
So how long did that building stay in place? When was it?
Oh, the barn?
Down? Yeah.
It was built around 1915, and it came down in the late 60s.
And then the Y?
The YMCA, the first YMCA in town, I think was built in 1909-ish. And then the second YMCA, which they recently moved out of to move to the third YMCA in town, I think that one was built also, I think, in the 60s as well.
And did they utilize the one that's still standing for any of that?
No.
Oh, yeah. So it was the one that preceded it that was the famous one.
Indeed. Yep.
So circuses aren't nearly as popular as they used to be, but they still do exist and they still are sole performers. Where do people tend to learn these skills now? It seems like it was far more organic at its heyday, and you could have people come from anywhere. And if somebody is a circus performer now, how do they learn the ropes?
I think they learn the ropes, some of them in families. They're third, fourth, fifth generation circus performers. I think Illinois State University is particularly positioned to help people learn about circus traditions through its Gamma Phi Circus. We are the largest and the longest running, I should say it that way, not necessarily the largest, but the longest running collegiate circus in the world. And that we've helped train a lot of people who do eventually go on to join circuses. Related to that, Ringling Brothers Barnum Bailey is coming out. They're having a soft opening. And then they're going to be doing another tour. They get as close as Rosemont, Illinois for us in November, I believe. So the circus, the word circus, has its root with the word for circle. And that makes sense because you think 3-ring, 1-ring, 5-ring circuses. It's all that ring. And what do we know about rings or circles is that there's no beginning, there's no end. They just keep going. They just keep morphing. And if we look back through circus history, we can see that it's really changed the format, the style, what is offered. And I think that's what we're experiencing now, is another revolution, if you will, of circus and its arts and how they're displayed and accepted.
As somebody that's a special collections librarian at Illinois State University, you know, obviously you have all this knowledge, but there's a lot of stuff at Milner Library in the collections. How large is the collection of circus-related memorabilia objects that are housed at Milner?
Oh, we have well over 1 million items in our circus and allied arts collection. So allied arts, what does that mean? It means magic. It means vaudeville. It means sideshow, the arts that are related to circus. But we have so many various types of things. We have correspondence. Performers to show management. We have contracts, how much they're making back in the 30s. I can tell you Art Cancello, for example, was making, you know, something lofty like $250 in the height of the Depression a week, which is mind-blowing. It's a lot of money for back in that day, but he's also risking his life, right? And his wife's life as well, because she was in the act as well. We have photographs, thousands of photographs in every format, from carte de vis to glass plate negative to Kodachrome slides and beyond. We have over 1,000 pieces of wardrobe dating from 1889 to 1980s. And we have cash books and ledgers. That's where all the true story of circus is told. And as I like to say to people, it's a business first. Yes, it's entertaining, but they're not in business not to make money. They can't do it unless they're making money, and that is evidenced in the cash books and ledgers. All the little pieces of paper that went into making a circus a lot of money are represented in our collection, and that's also why when I hear the phrase, my life is a circus, I think it should mean that your life is a well-oiled machine and you're making a lot of money doing it, instead of what it means, kind of the chaos thing today.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us about the circus history.
Yeah.
And thanks for coming to Heartland and telling the folks that are coming to that event about the circus. And I'm sure you'll have some interesting things to show them as well.
Yeah.
Very unique opportunity to see some of these things from the special collections at Milner Library.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I love talking about this. I have the best job. I don't know how I lucked into it, but I'm sure glad I did.
Maureen Brunsdale manages the special collections at Illinois State University's Milner Library. Those collections include over 1 million pieces of circus history. She will be speaking about that topic at Heartland Community College on Wednesday, October 18th, 2023. If you are interested in other interviews about history, performing arts, or other topics, subscribe to Random Acts of Knowledge on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you found this one. Thanks for listening.